Many of you know that I just spent the better part of 2 weeks touring the Holy Land, seeing Israel and Palestine, and it was such an eye-opening experience. I hope that many of you get the chance to do that. I had always envisioned pretty much every story that we read in the Bible playing out in a scene that looked much like this. Deserts, dryness, camels, kind of fun to ride one. But that's how I envision everything in the Bible happening out. The reality, though, is that the Holy Land is very little of it looks like this. There is some of that in the southern part, but there is a wide variety of landscape. There's the coastal plain along the Mediterranean Sea coast, a couple of beautiful mountain ranges, lush, fertile, hilly terrain in the north around the Sea of Galilee, just beautiful, and it made me appreciate why people could love that land so much. Going to Jerusalem, we spent about 3 days touring Jerusalem, and it was amazing to get to go to many of the places that we're reading about this week, some of the ones that we just read, like the Mount of Olives. And what I saw happening in me as I was going to these places and rereading the familiar stories in the places where they happened, I saw myself going, wow, now I see. Now I can understand why Jesus did this or why he said that, or I can understand why Mark wrote it this way. Now I see. Have you ever had an experience where maybe you saw something from a different perspective, or you went and saw something yourself and it opened up a whole new realm of understanding for you? Just to give you a more familiar example, when our family first moved here to the Free Village community about 6 years ago, in September, I was in the office every day, and my wife took the kids one afternoon on a warm September day to West Meadow Beach, and we had never been there before. And when they came home at dinner that night, they kept trying to describe to me how amazing it was. They kept calling it Heaven Beach. That was our kids' name for it, Heaven Beach. It was heavenly. I couldn't figure out what was the big deal about this beach. I mean, especially on the North Shore, you know, it's rocky, the waves aren't that big. But eventually I had to go see it for myself. And, you know, I went at sunset, almost at sunset one afternoon, at low tide when the winds were calm. And, you know, seeing the sun setting, facing the west, the sandbars, the calm waters, I could see why they would call it Heaven Beach. It's amazing. And you're not going to understand, so go for yourself later today. But have you ever had an experience like that where you come to a unique vantage point, or you see something for yourself and finally you're able to see it clearly? That's what I'm hoping will happen today as we look at Mark chapter 15. We've spent a little over 3 months now walking through the Gospel of Mark in this sermon series that we've called Coming into Focus. And we've been trying to get a clear view of Jesus, to really see who he is. And today, as we're coming near to the end of our series, we're going to see that ultimately there is really only one place where Jesus comes into focus, only one vantage point from which we can truly see who he is. No matter what you know about Jesus, what perspective you've seen him from before, if you don't see him where we see him today, you haven't really seen the full picture of who Jesus is. And here's why this vantage point matters so much. There is a question that really will be the most important question any of us have to answer. And it's a question that's been hanging over the entire story of Mark's gospel from the very beginning when the disciples who just started following Jesus watched him calm a storm. They said, who is this man? Who is Jesus? And it's the most important question any of us are ever going to have to answer, because it will determine what our lives look like. The way that we live, the way that we approach God, the way that we approach the ups and downs of life will all flow out of how we answer that question. Is Jesus the Son of God who gave his life for us, who is worthy of our allegiance, who is worthy of us trusting our entire lives to him? Or was he a teacher who had some wise sayings, but ultimately who was worthy of pity because of what happened to him, because of his delusions? Who is Jesus? It's a very important question, and we're going to work through it. But there's also a couple of hurdles that I think keep us from really answering that question well and really throwing our lives into what we say we believe about Jesus. And we're going to see some of those hurdles today. So that's what we're going to work through in Mark chapter 15. Who is Jesus? What do we see of him from this unique vantage point? And how do we deal with these hurdles that keep us from really believing and throwing our lives into who Jesus is? It's a very unique vantage point. So I would invite you to have a Bible open, if you haven't already opened it, to Mark chapter 15. And if you're using the Bible from the seat back in front of you, you can find it on page 1586. Now, I don't know if some of you have felt this tension, this discomfort that I've felt over the last few months, of having to work through the entire book of Mark in a kind of a really fast pace. It seemed like a great idea when we planned it last fall, you know, to start right after Christmas and finish on Easter with the resurrection on Easter. But along the way, it's been really hard because it's meant that we've had to skip over some things that we'd really like to spend time talking about. But we really feel that today because last week when Andrew left off, he mentioned how Judas had decided in that moment when Mary anointed Jesus with the perfume, he had decided that he was going to betray Jesus for money. And that was kind of the last plot point that we see. And there's a lot that happens between there and where we pick up today. So let me just try to bring you up to speed as to what's happened in that time. Jesus celebrated the Passover meal with his closest disciples on Thursday night. And when they finished the meal, they went out to a place called the Mount of Olives. Now, we had a great experience this week, Kim and I, being on the Mount of Olives. There are a number of olive trees that are there. And Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and then he came down. At the base of the mount is a garden called the Garden of Gethsemane. And this is what the garden looks like today. There are some ancient olive trees that are there. And we're pretty certain that this is actually the very place that Jesus fell down and prayed in agony to God. If there's any way to save your people without the cross, please let it be. And you know how that went. He said, not my will, but your will be done. And they think they've found the exact rock where Jesus actually laid down and cried out to God. But this is the garden where Jesus was arrested by the temple police, and then he would have been carried over to the house of Caiaphas, the Jewish high priest, where he would go through an unjust trial, and they probably threw him into a dungeon to spend the night. Archaeologists are fairly certain that they've discovered the very house of Caiaphas. We went there. We actually went down into the dungeon. I don't know if you can see this guy with the orange shirt who's way down in there, but they would have lowered Jesus on ropes down into that dungeon. And after the Jewish leaders had decided that Jesus should be crucified, they had to send him to Pilate, the Roman governor, because they didn't have the authority to crucify people themselves. And so in the early morning, they would have dragged Jesus up these very stairs. These are first century stairs that have been uncovered that lead from the base of the hill where Caiaphas' house was up to the old city of Jerusalem and into what they call Antonia Fortress. It was a fortress where Pilate would have had his headquarters when he came to Jerusalem. And if you remember the story, Pilate asked Jesus some questions, concludes, this guy is not, he's not worthy of condemnation. Let me send him over to Herod, the Jewish puppet king. And they sent him a block or two over to Herod's palace. And then Herod sent him back to Pilate. And we're pretty sure that they found the floor of the actual, what they call the praetorium in the Gospels, where Pilate interacted with Jesus, where the soldiers mocked Jesus. In fact, if you can look closely, this is a glass box with lights inside of it protecting a square on the floor, because archaeologists uncovered a game inscribed on the floor called the Game of the King. This is what the Roman soldiers would have played when they were bored. And this is most likely where they mocked Jesus, where they put the crown of thorns on him, the purple robe, right here. And after this point, you may recall, Pilate decided, okay, Jesus will be crucified, because Pilate was afraid of the crowds. And then from that point, Jesus would have carried the cross piece for his own cross out towards the city wall, very short distance, where we drop into the story today in Mark chapter 15. Now, as we look here today, we're going to be focusing mostly on the two statements, which I think are the climactic moment in the whole Gospel of Mark. And if we're going to understand their significance, we got to go back to chapter 1 for just a moment. Some of you were here when we started back in January. Some of you weren't. But it's important for us to remember that in Mark chapter 1, when we first see Jesus, he's baptized in the Jordan River by John the Baptist. And when Jesus comes up out of the water, two very important things happen. I have a couple of verses here on the screen from Mark chapter 1, verse 10, where we read, "Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, 'You are my son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased.'" Now, there are two very important things that happen there if we're going to understand what happens today. One is that the heavens were torn open. And you may remember, we talked about that word torn. It's the word rend, the word that speaks of a garment being ripped apart. When it speaks of God's action, it talks about his cataclysmic intervention in history, such as when he parts the Red Sea for his people to go through on dry land. He rends the sea apart. Now, when Mark uses this word, he wants us to think back. He's assuming his readers are familiar with the Old Testament scriptures. And he wants us to think back to something the prophet Isaiah said 700 years before Jesus. In fact, Heather read it this morning. Isaiah had cried out to God, "Oh, that you would rend the heavens, that you would tear open the heavens and come down. God, that you would hear our cry, that you would see our plight, the mess that we've made of the world, and that you would come down and rescue us." And when we see this same word show up in Mark chapter 1, it is telling us that God has heard that cry. It's good news. He's torn open the heavens. His Spirit has come down on Jesus to rescue us from the mess that we've made of the world. But then the other significant thing that happens here is that God speaks audibly to Jesus. He says, "You're my son." And that was something that Jesus desperately needed to hear, because he was about to be tested by Satan in the wilderness. He knew he was going to a cross. He knew that this rescue mission was going to be dangerous and difficult. And he needed the affirmation from his father of who he was. "You are my son. I love you. I'm pleased with you." But it seems, as we read the story, that nobody else in that moment in chapter 1, either nobody heard God say that, or more likely, nobody really got it. They didn't grasp what God had said about Jesus, because the rest of Mark's gospel shows us people who just don't get who Jesus is. Every now and then, they get a little sliver of who he is. You know, people see him do amazing things. Crowds see Jesus heal people from lifelong diseases. They see him touch the untouchables like lepers and give them back their lives. Grieving mothers see him raise their dead children. The disciples watch him calm a hurricane force storm with just a word. People see him turn a sack lunch into a feast for at least 5,000 people. I mean, they see him doing amazing things, casting out demons. And yet they only get little slivers of who he is. Now, at one point, Peter comes pretty close. Chapter 8, Peter says, "You are the Messiah. You are the King sent from God who will put away all kings, who's going to bring God's kingdom." But even then, Peter's understanding was distorted, because he was thinking that Jesus was going to be a militaristic king who would defeat the Romans once and for all. And nobody's getting it. This question is hanging over the gospel. Who is Jesus? And the whole time, nobody can figure it out until what we see today. In chapter 15, Jesus is hanging on the cross. The climax of the whole story comes in verses 38 and 39. "The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" Now, these two sentences show us that the death of Jesus was not some horrible tragedy. It's not something to pity. This was a moment of great fulfillment. This is when it all came together. This is the first time that any human being has recognized fully who Jesus is, the Son of God. And that crucial recognition, it comes about not in response to some miracle, healing or exorcism or a resurrection. No, it doesn't come in response to any of those things. It comes in response to seeing Jesus hang on a cross and die. And you know what else is really ironic about it? That proclamation of who Jesus is, the Son of God, it doesn't come from the lips of anybody that it should have come from. It doesn't come from a teacher of the law or a temple priest or even one of the 12 disciples who have been with Jesus for 3 years. It comes from the captain of the Roman death squad, the chief executioner. He's the one that gets it, who says, "This is the Son of God." You see, here's the big point that you can't miss in today's story, and I think it's probably the big point in the whole Gospel of Mark. Only at the cross does Jesus really come into focus. You can see Jesus teaching, and you get a glimpse of his wisdom. You can see him healing and get a sense of his care. You can see him touching the lepers and get a sense for his compassion. You can see him doing lots of things, but only when you see him refusing to come down from the cross do you see Jesus as the Son of God who gave his life for you. Now, let me explain. As Mark tells the story, there are a number of details that he brings out, that he emphasizes. But you know what? There's something he doesn't really emphasize that much, and you know what it is? It's the physical horror of crucifixion. You know, he just says it very succinctly, verse 24, they crucified him. He doesn't elaborate because his readers in Rome in the first century knew it all too well. They had seen it happen. They knew that this is not just the death penalty, that this is absolute torture, that this is dying in shame. Because what they did is they would strip you naked if you were going to be crucified. They would sometimes nail you, sometimes tie you to the crossbeam, drive a spike through your heel bone, into the vertical piece of wood, and then they would crucify you right next to the main road, just outside the city wall, so that everybody passing in and out of the city would see you hanging there naked. So there's the shame piece. There's the physical torture, because it would usually take several days for people to die. You would be hanging by your arms like this so that you couldn't get a full breath, and so you'd have to push yourself up with your feet that have a spike through them in order to breathe, and then you would fall back down, and eventually you would run out of the strength to do that, and so you would suffocate and die. And this was this was like their final, ultimate terror apparatus. This was Rome's final way of saying, "We own you. Don't you dare rebel against us, because if you do, this is what's going to happen to you." Mark doesn't go into that because he knows that his readers would understand it. But you know what Mark does emphasize as he tells the story? A few things. One of them that he says over and over is the mockery that Jesus experienced. Mark tells us that Jesus was mocked by people at every level of society. If we go back a few verses, we see Jesus is mocked during his arrest and his trial by the Roman soldiers. We get to the cross and Jesus is mocked by all the common people passing by on the road. He's mocked by the Jewish religious leaders. He's mocked by the criminals hanging next to him. Everybody is mocking Jesus. And they're all saying basically the same thing. Do you know what it is? The heart of their mockery? It's in verse 32. "If you're the Messiah, come down that we may see and believe." You think you're some king sent from God? Then why are you hanging on a cross? If you're all that, then just come down. Then we'll believe who you are. You see, this is showing us the biggest roadblock to believing that Jesus is who he says he is. This was the big hurdle for everybody who was present, for everybody in the first century world, Jews, Romans, Greeks. This was it, the fact that he was a crucified Messiah. Nobody in that time and place can conceive of a Messiah who would be crucified. It just didn't happen. If you were Jewish, you knew what the law said in Deuteronomy, that anyone who is hung on a tree is cursed by God. So how could you be sent from God to save us if you're under his curse? Impossible. If you're a Roman, listen, the idea of suffering for other people was not considered virtuous in the Roman world. It made you a loser. Because only the weak suffer, the strong survive. So if you're up there suffering, you're not sent from God, you're not divine, you're a loser. This was the big roadblock, a crucified Messiah. And so people are saying, "Hey, show your power, come down, then we'll believe you're who you say you are." Of course, the irony there is that people have been saying that all along. Do a sign for us, Jesus, then we'll believe. And Jesus has been doing them, not on demand, but he's done plenty of them, and people still haven't believed who he was, by and large. And now that this thing has just reached its logical end, hey, if you're the Messiah, come down. There's no such thing as a crucified Messiah. This is why Peter and the other apostles have headed for the hills and locked themselves inside a locked room. Because in their minds, everything that they've given their lives up for has come to nothing. It's all been in vain if Jesus is hanging on a cross. He must not have been who he said he was. And yet one of the great ironies in the story is that the only one who actually does see and believe is the captain of the death squad, the one who sees Jesus refusing to come down when he could have. The key that opens his eyes is that Jesus is still hanging on the cross. Only in refusing to come down from the cross when he could have is Jesus seen as the Son of God that he is. Just a little side note about this centurion, this Roman soldier. If he, the Gentile who is in charge of putting people to death, as unclean as they get, if he can have his eyes open to see who Jesus is and profess his faith in Jesus, nobody is outside of God's reach. You know, we've mentioned Alpha. We hope that you're praying for people, that you're inviting people to come. And I think what happens oftentimes is that we relate with people who seem like they're too far gone. Their lives are too messy. God could never reach them. And we give up on them. But listen, if it can happen with this guy, sending people to their death, God can do it for anybody. And your job is simply to pray for them and invite them and let God change their hearts. He can do it. For every person in this scene who is watching Jesus die, except the centurion, the big hurdle to believing Jesus is that he was crucified. But you know what? I'm not sure that our hurdle to really believing, really trusting him with our lives, I don't think our big hurdle is a crucified Messiah, because most of us have grown up hearing about that, at least to some degree, seeing crucifixes. We know, you know, Jesus died. I think there are two hurdles that really keep us from putting all of our faith in Jesus, really trusting with our lives. I think that one is that we don't want to believe that it was necessary. Jesus really didn't have to go that far for us. And two, I think we have a hard time. We get hung up on the fact that Jesus doesn't remove our crosses when we want him to. And I think these things keep us from really trusting him wholeheartedly. Now, I want to explain this because these are crucial for what I think we need to understand today. First, I think we get hung up on the fact, not so much that Jesus was a crucified Messiah, but on the idea that he had to go that far for us, that it was really necessary. I mean, we're not that bad of people, right? We try hard, we work hard, pretty moral, decent people. He didn't really have to go to the cross for us, did he? You see, from the very first moment, way back in the beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 3, when the first man and woman believed Satan's lie that God couldn't be trusted, that God wasn't interested in their well-being, that if they wanted anything good, they had to take matters into their own hands. And from that moment where they ate the forbidden fruit, people were and always have been separated from God. And the lie that they believe that God can't be trusted, it has seeped into the DNA of every human being ever since. You know what it's like to be separated from someone by sin? I mean, just think about it this way. Think about a time when you've lied to someone, or someone has lied to you. Almost immediately, you get this feeling of distance, right? The relationship is broken. The trust has been broken. And if reconciliation is going to happen, it's going to take a lot of costly work. That's what's happened in our relationship with God from the very beginning, when people chose to sin. Every one of us has bought into that lie. We've taken matters into our own hands. We've created distance between us and God. And if we are cut off from access to God, and God is the source of life, who we long for and who we need, we're in a desperate situation. And yet, all throughout the story of the Bible, the Old Testament story, God has been dropping hints that there was a way out, that there is a way that this problem could be fixed. We see it show up in lots of places, but three particular places that I want you to think about today. Psalm 22, Psalm 69, and Isaiah 53. In all of those places, there is a common motif. And this common motif says that if there is a perfectly righteous person who suffers vicariously for unrighteous people, a person who doesn't deserve to suffer, suffering for those who do, then the curse will be broken. Then we can have permanent access to God again. Our relationship with him can be restored. Now, why do I mention those three examples to you in particular? Because Mark brings them out in chapter 15, the crucifixion. He wants you to think about them. For example, verse 34. Jesus cried out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's the only time in all the Gospels that Jesus addresses God and doesn't call him Father. He's lost intimacy with his Father. He's completely cut off. And where do these words come from? My God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22, the motif of a righteous man suffering unjustly for the unrighteous, abandoned by God, totally cut off. And then we see people offering Jesus vinegar to drink. Imagine you're suffering incredible pain and someone sticks a sponge full of vinegar in your mouth. I mean, this is a taunt. You know what it calls to mind? Psalm 69. The righteous man whose friend betrays him by putting gall or some type of vinegar in his food. You know what else that righteous man says in Psalm 69? He says, I am forced to restore what I didn't steal. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing. He's restoring what we stole. And then Mark tells us that complete darkness fell over the whole land. What's darkness in the Old Testament? It's a sign of God's judgment. We see it in places like the plagues in Egypt when darkness fell over the land. So people have tried to say over the years that this must have been an eclipse that just coincided with Jesus' death. That wasn't the case. It's very hard to back that up. This is darkness that is, in essence, the fullness of God's judgment. It is showing us that Jesus in this moment is in complete spiritual darkness. He has lived in the light of God's presence for eternity past, and suddenly that's gone. We deserved it. He got it. And we see Jesus surrounded by criminals, people who, at least in Rome's system, actually deserve their punishment. And what does that remind us of? Isaiah 53. He was numbered with the transgressors. The righteous man suffering vicariously for the unrighteous. Somebody else offers Jesus another drink. Wine mixed with myrrh. You know what myrrh was? It was a narcotic. It deadened the senses. Compassionate people would go to crucifixions and give it to the dying man as a way of showing pity. And what does Jesus do? He refuses it. You know why? Because it was necessary for him to have his full senses, his full wits about him as he experienced the torment of being cut off from God. Why? Because that was how severe our sin was. That was the judgment that we deserved. And he takes it entirely. You see, we were all destined to be eternally cut off from God in utter and hopeless darkness unless a perfectly righteous child of God would take that as our substitute. And you know what? If in this moment Jesus hears the mocking, come down from the cross, then we'll believe. And if he uses his special status with God, if he uses his power and he actually comes down, you know what? The whole thing's off. It doesn't work. We're still in our sin. We still have to be afraid of death. We still have to deal with our guilt before God. It wouldn't have worked. Jesus had to go all the way. And Mark tells us that he did. Verse 37, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. You know what that loud cry was? John tells us in his accounting of the story, it is finished. It's accomplished. Everything that you needed has been done. And now Jesus can breathe his last. And Mark makes sure that we know that it worked. He tells us in verse 38, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, we talked about that a little bit a few weeks ago, this curtain of the temple. I want to make sure that you remember what we're talking about, because this is very important for us to understand. This is the diagram. I keep bringing this laser pointer. It doesn't work on the screen. Oh, well, it still feels fun to have in my hand. This is a diagram of the temple that King Herod the Great built for the Jewish people in the first century. We talked about the outer courts the outer courts of the Gentiles a few weeks ago. But if you look at that tall piece, right? Is that you, Nick, putting that green spot up there? Cool. All right. Move it over the tall bit. There you go, right there. That was called the holy place. This was the most sacred part of the Jewish temple. Within it was the Holy of Holies. This is where they kept the Ark of the Covenant with the tablets of the law from Mount Sinai. It was thought that God's literal presence dwelt there. And do you know who got to go into the Holy of Holies? One person, one day per year, the high priest. And he went in risking his very life. In the presence of a holy God, he would bring sacrifices for the forgiveness of his people's sins, and they would wait in suspense outside, not knowing if he was going to come out alive. But when he did, that meant that God had accepted their sacrifice, that they could live joyfully for another year until it all happened again. And outside the Holy of Holies, there was a curtain that kept people from going in. And when Mark tells us that Jesus breathed his last and that curtain was torn in two, he's telling us that access to God's presence, what we've all hungered for, it's been thrown open wide. Let me try to convey this to you in a slightly different way. One of the most poignant experiences that we had this last week in Jerusalem was going to the Wailing Wall at the Temple Mount. I think we have a picture of this. I took this picture on Tuesday afternoon. This big wall in the middle, you may have heard of this. It shows up on the news every now and then when tensions flare. It's called the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. It's part of the Western Wall of the temple that still stands from the first century. Now, when the Romans conquered Jerusalem in 70 AD, after Jesus' life, they destroyed most of the temple, but this Western Wall still stands. And this is today considered to be the most holy place in the whole world for Jewish people. Thousands of people flock here every day. They put their hands on the wall. They lay against it. They wail. They cry out to God. Do you know why it's so sacred? Because the thought is that this is the closest that a human being can ever get to the Holy of Holies. This is as close as you can get to God's presence. Now, where the Holy of Holies was on the other side of the wall, it's most likely destroyed. It's been under Roman Muslim control for many centuries, and so they haven't let anybody come to excavate it. But the thought is still that if you can only get to this wall, you are at the closest to God's presence that you can ever get. And maybe if you get there, God will hear your prayers. You have a better chance because you're so close to the Holy of Holies. When I was there this week, you know, I expected that when we went there, I would want to walk up to the wall and do the thing where you lay against it and maybe take a selfie like a lot of people do. But we went through security, we got here, and you know what I felt? I kind of felt like I don't need to go up to the wall. In fact, I'm very happy to stand back here. You know why? Because when Jesus breathed his last and the curtain of the temple was torn in two, he said, "Come in." The wall's been torn down. You get to go into the Holy of Holies. You get access. You don't have to make a pilgrimage to some far part of the world to know that God's going to hear your prayer, to know that God loves you, that he favors you, that he's cheering for you. Jesus accomplished that on the cross. You know, when Mark says the curtain of the temple was torn in two, you know what that word is, torn? Rend. We saw it once in Mark 1. God tore open the heavens to come down on Jesus and rescue us. And now we see it here. The curtain of the temple is being torn. It's like the direction has been reversed. Because of what Jesus has done, you get to go in. You get to go up. Access has been thrown open wide. All that to say, it was necessary. What Jesus did, we were desperate for it, and it worked. We've been given the ability to go into the Holy of Holies, the very presence of God through Jesus. But there's this other hurdle that I mentioned earlier that keeps us from really putting our confidence in Jesus. And I think this hurdle is not so much that he was a crucified Messiah, but that Jesus doesn't take away our crosses when we ask him to. See, life is full of crosses. We talk about, you know, taking up your cross, and we're usually speaking about trials, health problems that we deal with in our bodies, or loved ones that we lose, or unemployment or financial difficulties. And we have this feeling that if Jesus is who he says he is, we should be able to ask him to take those things away, and he will. We become a lot like the bystanders in the story who say, Jesus, come down from the cross and then we'll see and believe. We don't say, come down from the cross. We say, Jesus, take these things away and then we'll see and believe. Some of us even become followers of Jesus because we think, maybe somebody's misled us to think that if we only trust in him, then life will get easy and smooth. But we forget what Jesus told the disciples right after he told them he had to go to a cross. He said, if you're going to follow me, you're going to take up a cross of your own. You're going to have to let your agenda die every day and take up my agenda for your life. You're going to have to let your self-made identity die and take up the identity that I give you. For all of you, it's going to mean sacrifice. For some of you, it's going to mean literal death. We forget that. And we say, Jesus, take these things away. Then we'll see and believe. You know what I think? I think this is the place where for most of us, the life gets sucked out of our faith. Hard things happen. Jesus doesn't respond the way we want him to, and we say, you know what? That's it. Listen, if you need proof that Jesus is the Son of God who gave his life for you, if you need proof that he's for you, that he loves you, that he's powerful, you need to look no farther than the cross. You need to see the same thing the centurion saw, Jesus refusing to come down when he could have. That is the very best thing to stoke your confidence in him, because it tells you that he loves you that much, that he would go to that length. It tells you that you can trust him, if he's going to do that for you. When your body is hurting and you're not getting well, when a loved one is having difficulties, when finances are hard, don't say, take this away and then I'll believe. Say, Lord Jesus, I see you on the cross and I believe because you did that for me. You see, this term, Son of God, that culminates the whole gospel, it's a very special term. It only shows up a few times before Jesus. God uses it to speak of the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. They were his specially chosen child. They were to enjoy special access to him. They were to represent him on earth. And what happened? They squandered that opportunity. And then God uses it about King David. He calls him my son, because David had a heart like God's heart. He was to be a shepherd king the way that God shepherded his people. And David did a lot of good. You know what he did when the rubber met the road? He stole somebody else's wife and then killed the man to cover up for it. He failed as God's son. And now the real Son of God has shown up. He's done it perfectly. He's lived a life of perfect love, of perfect righteousness. And how does God reward him? By abandoning him on a cross. By not responding when Jesus cries out. What kind of special love is that for your son? You know what it is? It's love for you. It's love for you that would stop at nothing. Only at the cross does Jesus truly come into focus. And when you find it hard to trust him because of your circumstances, you think about him staying on the cross for you when he could have come down. That's how much he loves you. That's how much you can trust him. And only when you see him there will you find the means to do and be what he asks of you. Let's pray.